Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Mike Colomeco from Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Hamilton, and we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in front of a live audience. And I'm really excited today because I've gotten to know this man on my right really well. We've had some deep conversations.
We have.
We really have.
Sorry.
I can't wait to have him reveal a little of himself to you folks. But Ignacio Matos is an incredibly celebrated chef. Since he's hit the scene in New York City, his restaurants and his reputation has just skyrocketed. And we're going to go through his career of where he has worked, but he has really reached a pinnacle in the profession with his two restaurants, Estella and Altera Paradiso. He's gotten the recognition Estella is on the 50 greatest restaurant list of the world. But you know what is more exciting to me? Almost every chef in New York that I meet and I say, where do you like to eat? It's in your restaurants. And I know you have a great team behind you, and we're going to go into that too. But Ignacio, welcome to ICC and
Thank
Chef
you.
Story.
Pleasure.
Okay, so what we're going to do, it's all about you.
All right.
Yeah. And we want to know how you became you. And I want, the first thing, I know you're from Uruguay.
Uruguay, correct.
And I know you've told people that's where Jesus Christ is from.
Well,
he was born there, right?
Yeah, but then they changed their mind.
No,
I realized it wasn't that great of a place to.
Well, tell me about Uruguay and how.
Small little country, 3.5 million of people, mix of Spanish, Italian, for the most part, heritage, but no, with any particular culinary identity, I would say, you know. It's a lot of things that we do, but like they're all related with, you know, they're connected with some other culture rather than something
indigenous.
It's not really any trace of natives or anything, so we don't have any background like, you know, Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Brazil, they might have. So it's,
So what are some of your first food memories?
Food memories. I mean, on my grandmother's side, it's Italian, so we grew up eating mostly Italian immigrant food adapted to whatever circumstances, you know, like it's a place that, you know, it was really hard at a time to find like coffee, and they grew up, you know, they would have coffee and like good cheeses and stuff like that. So they adapted to whatever ingredients they would be able to source, or they would start producing.
How Italian was your grandmother? When did the Italian side of the family go to immigrate?
Her mom was Italian, and my grandmother, she was born in Uruguay, but the mom was pregnant on the boat. Yeah, I was like, on the boat, yeah.
So, you know, they say that the Italian food in New York is its own thing. You know, meatballs and spaghetti isn't an Italian thing. It's an American-Italian. And Italian-Americans adapted what they found here mm-hmm. to approximate their cuisine. Is there an Uruguay Italian cuisine like that? Are there dishes only found in Uruguay?
There is certain adaptations for sure, like in the type of ravioli, or how they do the meat sauces and stuff like that. But it's Italian to an extent, but maybe it's more similar to an American Italian way. But it's interesting. You find different things, but the background was from Liguria. And Milano, most like the traces from my family. So I, you know, traveling to Italy, I started figuring it out like, I grew up eating Ligurian food mm-hmm. for the most part. You know, all these dishes start popping up and making sense. Oh, you know, like Pasqualina. There is this pie that has a very interesting story, but it's pretty much a Swiss chard. Pie. What else? Farinata, that is a chickpea flour.
But in Uruguay, you have a very strong meat culture, correct?
Yes.
And in Italy, really, it's not a very strong, other than
veal. That's the thing, they get there, and, you know, it was a lot of abundance when they get there. You know, Italian and Spanish, they all could come, you know, for different circumstances, starving to this place, and all of a sudden it's just like cows everywhere, you know, it's like green fields, and
So growing up, did you feel Italian? Did you feel Uruguayan?
I felt Uruguayan. Definitely. Yeah, no, the culture is a very strong, we have a very strong DNA, even if we're a melting pot, it's a very interesting, a passionate culture, and mostly we express it to soccer, but it gets very intense with soccer. Even if we're a small little country, it's just, it is when things go crazy.
Did you want to be a soccer player growing up?
Of course. Of course. That's what you're meant to. You're a boy that threw a ball at you, and you're like, you better be good at it. Whatever else you do, they're like, great.
All right, so we're going to go back to your cooking life. So I believe your grandmother was very strong influence for you growing up. So
for sure.
Did she teach you how to cook?
Yeah, to an extent, of course. But, you grew up around the table and around the kitchen, and you're always bothering, and there's no room to mess around. If you want to be in the kitchen, you want to be helping. If you want to be helping, you would learn. And, of course, it's a lot of labor-intensive kind of preparations, perhaps making raviolis, and she would roll the pasta with a pin by hand, and of course it would be very labor intense. We were small and we didn't have enough weight to put into the pin. Of course it wasn't much to do, but once, you know, we were teenagers, like she was like, okay, you can put all that energy into this. So we were like rolling pasta and doing stuff like that. But also helping with, you know, like we have a farm and I was actually, yesterday we were talking, I'm just mixing it all up, but we were doing a recipe for the book that we're doing. And it was about blood sausage and blood cake. And I just, one fond memory, it's, you know, killing a pig and collecting the blood and stirring blood on a bucket while it's hot so it doesn't coagulate. But the smell is a very special smell. The sound also, but going back to what you were asking, yes, you will be helping in many different ways, and it's a lot of memories. Like, and we will be helping preserving, you know, peaches on the summer and peppers in oil, tomato sauce, and all those things that were, I really hated it. Like, it was summertime, and I would rather be
playing soccer.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So when did you have an inkling you wanted to be a chef? What age?
I knew that I wanted to cook like around 15, 16. But a chef, I don't know. I remember watching certain TV shows and stuff like that. But I never meet any chef. Or
did you go to restaurants a lot?
No. Uruguay is not a place that you go that much to restaurant. Would you eat at home? So I didn't have that connection. Of course, I watched certain TV shows, but also it wasn't a time where chef was a cool thing to mention, you know? But I really, I'm not that old anyway, but yeah, I don't know. I wasn't really with the idea of like becoming a chef. I get really into cooking. And somehow I ended up at the right places at the right time. And
what was your first job in a restaurant?
I worked in like this in a catering with these two old ladies and a dog for a split of a second. It was very interesting, but they teach me a lot about hard work.
Really? I mean, in what way? How old
like
were the ladies?
I don't know. Like 70-something. They were amazing. Yeah, they were amazing. But they couldn't sleep at night, so they were doing these catering gigs. And they love it. And we talk a lot of shit. But, yeah, and this was back in my town, and they would be gossiping. It was very interesting. I knew a few people that were gossiping about. But in a restaurant, I entered to a restaurant, and it wasn't really that charming. It was a good restaurant in Uruguay. It wasn't something that I was just looking forward to be. I was like, really? This is the kitchen? I didn't want to get into details, but, you know, it wasn't that clean. It was just like, this is just lame. But then I got lucky, and they sent me over this other kitchen, and it was this chef called Michel Kerber. That was a main crush. But it was this French guy, you know, dressed with a chef coat, and he has a tie and these shiny shoes, and like he was moving on the kitchen in this very specific, seductive way, you know, like with a lot of confidence. And I didn't have any idea who he was until six, 7 years ago. And he was Alain Passard's mentor. And it was back on the day. I have no clue who he was, but I ended up in this kitchen. And I don't know who many know who's Alain Passard, but it's just pretty amazing. But this was his mentor. And, you know, and I knew, of course, who Alain Passard was.
Was this in Montevideo?
Montevideo. And he was there doing a consulting 6 months a year. And I get to spend those 6 months with him. And, I mean, it was fascinating to see him cooking and connecting with...
So let me take you back a little bit. I guess you went into cooking because you loved food. and mm-hmm. so you were drawn to the restaurant. But then to see someone like Alain Passard's mentor cooking in that level of restaurant, had you ever eaten in a restaurant of that caliber?
No.
So what did you think of the... What kind of food did you... I know.
Maybe New York. No, at home.
No. So all of a sudden you're making this food with a lot of technique in it.
Mm-hmm.
And did you get to taste the food?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And then did it change your... He would even, yeah, well, sometimes
well,
you're not
Well, he was doing Ratatouille, and, like, he was very, it was fascinating to see him, you know, how he connect what he was doing. It was a very intense way of cooking. That it had a big impact in the way that I cook indirectly, but also, you know, seeing Alain Passard cook, you could see where that came from.
What was the difference between working for the two 70-year-old women and then working for a chef like this? What is the difference in what you see and what you learn?
Well, it was attention to detail, you know, and the passion, the commitment. I mean, these ladies were super hard workers. But, yeah, definitely the intensity of how you do things, you know. Like, this guy was, like, connecting what he was doing. Definitely putting energy into it. Put in, you know,
was there a special, was it meat, was it...
Ratatouille. He was doing ratatouille a lot of time. And I was like, oh, I got this. And I see him, and every time I try to reach it, I get hit on the hand. And I was like, puck. Okay, got it. Don't touch it. I watch. Well, he was speaking in French. I had no idea what he was saying. But, you know, the tap always worked. Not anymore.
How many hours a week did you work there?
I was doing 8 hours there, then I was going to school and then going to work with the ladies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And at school, was it culinary school or was
it
regular
culinary school?
So while you were working 8 hours there, then culinary school, and then after that, these ladies were up late.
Yeah. They would start at midnight or something, and I would go work from midnight to 6:30 in the morning, then take a shower, take a bath, go work, sleep a little bit in between, go to school, and then go to work again. It was exciting. I love it. I found what I love, and I have, you know, it was an interesting time. I had no idea what I was going to do, and all of a sudden that fell into my lap, which I feel very lucky.
What year, how old were you when you were at that restaurant?
I think that was like 97.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then did you go to work for Francis Malman after
Then after that I went to work for Francis Malman, that also have no idea who he was. He looked exotic. And
he is exotic, yes.
Definitely. So I was like, exotic, I take that. So I started working. I stashed with him and spent a winter at this place that he used to have called Los Negros, and it's like the most beautiful place, but also really small place, and we were able, in the other kitchens, you weren't able to have your hands around everything, and this restaurant, you were doing everything, from the bread to the desserts to the sauces. It was just cleaning, doing everything. It was like...
How long were you there for?
I mean, we did a winter, then, well, after that, I started working for him. Like, I worked for like 8 years.
So what did you learn from Francis?
Everything. Pretty much. I tried to learn everything. It was some things that, no, I mean, like, you know, he's his own thing.
He's very unique, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't think Americans know him all that well because...
After that TV show...
They've seen him, but I don't think that they know his food and his style. Yeah. Well, if you had to describe him, and what would you say as unique from other chefs, and what do you think he uniquely gave you?
The interesting thing about Francis is like he doesn't really have those many rules. He has parameters, but within those parameters, he doesn't care. He's, you know, as long as you are within those parameters, he's free. And he really teach you how to be free. and not restrain yourself. You know, it's like you have techniques, but he will always be challenging. Why we don't, you know, like, oh, you're supposed to cook this in a very slow temperature. He's like, go as hard as you can go, you know, with the opposite. Or, you know, he got for a very French trained background, and he get all fed up with the whole fine dining and like all the French way of doing things. And for me, it was interesting because now he's in a different place. He's kind of doing his thing, but I was like through the transition of like him being all fed up with his way of doing things, and I was through the process that he was grappling, trying to figure it out, like his way of doing it.
Wasn't that long, 8 years to spend with one person?
One chef? I don't know. I have fun. I was doing what I love. I learned a lot.
Was it a constant learning, even, you know, 8 years in?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we were able to travel. We were, you know, it was very interesting. But yeah, there is a lot to learn, you know, and that's another subject. But yeah, I think it's important to put your time before you start doing, I don't know, you have to learn it from A to C to C to A and south to north, west to east. Like, it's very important you understand what you're doing, you know, and like until, you know, it's like it becomes, I don't know, I never get bored.
You know when you wanted to move on?
When we would argue a lot. we get to argue a lot. It was an interesting, And he kind of like, he's like, all right, it's time.
So
he's like very encouraging and like, yeah. He connected me with someone here in New York, and he was like, you should do this. I think you can handle it. I'm like, I don't know. But yeah, I did it.
So you came to New York in
2006.
2006. And
2006, 2007.
And where was the first place you...
Il Buco.
Il Buco. So with Donna?
Donna.
Yes. And Peter Kaminsky, did he have anything to do with that?
Yeah, Peter Kaminsky was a good friend of Francis.
Yes.
And I met Peter back in the day cooking in some inhospitable place in Argentina. And yes, we were doing this picnic, and yeah, we meet with Peter, and then they did the connection, and I ended up meeting Donna and cooking at Il Buco, which is an amazing place down the street.
So... And it was known for its Italian food.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Francis's food is not, Francis is not Italian food. So were you, what did you do to do the menu at Il Buco? How did you conceive that? And now you have your own kitchen. What mm-hmm. was that like?
I mean, I spent time traveling, I spent time in kitchens. While with Francis, I would go to kitchens and stuff like that, and everything made sense. I spent time in Italy, and like I fell in love with the food. I mean, I grew up eating that stuff, but the whole process, it was interesting. It was very interesting because every season the menu is supposed to change, and I was like, what? So it was a little bit, you know, with France, it was like, it was different. It was a different structure, and the menu here, it was constantly changing, supposed to be changing every day. So it was an interesting process in pushing yourself out of the comfort zone and figuring out, like, you know, I kind of roll with the punches.
So when you first had your own kitchen, you're the chef, after all those years, you kind of say to yourself, when I have my own kitchen and I'm my own chef, mm-hmm. it's going to be this way. What kinds of things did you want to do in your kitchen that you felt strongly about and carries through to today?
I think it's different, you know. Like my kitchen, I mean, that's Estela. Like all the other kitchens, you know, I was running the kitchen. But it's very difficult when, like, I don't think. I think at Estela, finally, I was able to do that, to do how I, you know, we doing it, how we want things to be, how I envision, how, as a cook, I would love the kitchen that I'm working at to be. I don't know. At Il Buco, it's different. You're coming to a kitchen that was already set. All the rules were in place. Things, space, like everything was defined and determined, and like it was just very hard to break into it. I mean, of course, you improve it and you do adjustments.
Give me an example of a dish that, you know, in a normal restaurant or somebody else's restaurant you wouldn't find, and at Estela you would find. What dish really kind of hones into the DNA of Estela?
I mean, the tartare.
Why? What about the tartare?
And interestingly, with the tartare, I start with a dish at Il Buco. You know, the original started at Il Buco. But, you know, maybe I wasn't mature enough to figure it out to the point that I figured it out down the line. I know, it's pretty bold. It's a very bold dish. What it makes it unique? Understanding the ingredients and how those ingredients are layered within a certain way and order.
Don't understand that.
I don't know. We have this, I mean, it's a very simple dish. It's just like bison with sanchok chips, fish sauce, pickle, green elderberries, and what else? I'm missing, Shake. You've done it more often than I lately. Lemon, chili, yeah, and a little chili. So Shake's run. He was running the kitchen, not anymore. Now he's in vacation. So we open a new place. But in the meantime, he's chilling, kind of. But it's, again, a pretty bold dish. That's how we do things over at Estela. I personally really like eating clean food. And the whole purpose of Estela was like how to simplify the dishes, you know? And I think that's kind of like what defined, you know, like the food at Estela, it looks in a way that it's very unassuming. Like when you eat it, you're like, holy fuck. Sorry.
It's Heritage Radio. You can say whatever you want.
You can say it.
Right, Aaron?
But you are like, you just get caught by surprise because it's not what you're expecting to be. It just looks very unassuming. And it's kind of like the play that we take on it. Also, it's this whole idea of like for me, it doesn't really matter how it looks. It doesn't taste and eats well. However, there is a lot of attention at the visual of it. It's like a lot of thought put into it, but like the visual cannot determine. It's like the taste and how it eats comes first. However, they're curated dishes that are not just like, I mean, and even if it's like, you know, the tartare is like a pile, and and it's put up in that way in purpose. It's just because that's like, it doesn't matter how it looks, mm-hmm. It's how it tastes and eats above anything else.
I didn't want to get into this till later, but since we're talking about Estela, I mean, to make the 50 greatest restaurant list is, you know, some chefs, they work their whole life, they kill for this, you know, they think they have to have a 3-star Michelin, multi-million dollar, you know, bathroom.
You're complaining about our bathroom, don't you?
No. The thing that is so amazing, and the only place I think that Michelin lets people get away with it is in Japan. I mean, you know, down in the subway, they have 3-star Michelin places in Japan. I mean, Estella just breaks the mold of what people think is going to make the 50 top restaurant list. But, you know, if you talk to chefs, I mean, it's their favorite place to eat. Did you create that place thinking it was going to be as well regarded as it is and being placed on that list of...
I believe so. But, I mean, I don't know. We focus on the day-to-day.
I mean, is it when you go there, you say, hey, I want to do my stuff, but, boy, I really want to knock it out of the park. And
Jake?
So are you competitive with yourself as opposed to you ever look at other restaurants?
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that we said from day one. I went into a bubble. And I was like, I didn't give a fuck about what people were doing. I didn't want to look at photos of food. Seriously, when we opened, it was a time where, like, Scandinavian food is like, I'm like, I don't care about this. I eat that stuff. I think it's great what they do. Like, we're in New York. It's like, fine. I want more salt on my food. I want it, you know? But I love it, but I think it has its place. But I think everybody all of a sudden, it was just copying each other and was doing all this stuff. And I'm like, this is stupid. It's like, I don't want to do this. I want to find out what we're made out of, you know? Like, for me, it was challenging myself also in many different ways. But, you know, like, all of a sudden, everybody's using all these ceramic plates. And, you know, I was like, I want the most standard crappy plate that we can find. You know, of course, they need to feel good, they need to look good, but it's just a simple white plate that was a lot of restraint within the plate itself. So you could not have, like, negative space, perhaps. Everybody was, you have one thing here and the other thing is there, and I was like, what the hell is this? You know, like... how I eat this, you know, and all of a sudden you get instructions how to eat it. It's just like, I was like, I want delicious food. But still, it can be thought put into it. And it was also about stripping down all the bullshit that they would come with dining, you know. And I come from doing tasting menu and, you know, a prefix menu, better said, and... you know, that created a lot of challenge to a lot of people at the time in New York that we did this place in Brooklyn. And all of a sudden, we were like, okay, we have this place. I team up with my partner, and we were at both on a stage. We were like, okay, we cannot fuck this one up. We need to make this one work. We found a space that, yes, it wasn't ideal, but it felt right. And we had to make it work, you know. The kitchen is still pretty much the original skeleton. And everything was based, okay, what we can do out of this place that only has a flat top. And you have a small stove and a salamander. That was all we have. And we didn't want to, I didn't want to have any gimmicky trick or whatever. I just want to keep it as basic and straightforward and really restrain ourselves as to the limit so we could find a way of finding an identity. I mean, I think that was also the biggest motivation is like, okay, like we need to find our own identity. And that's, I guess, is why the place is also successful, but not just on the food, but it's like, you know, service wise and like the people that works there and like everybody that works there really loves working there. And that was part of the whole foundation behind it. But like,
how much of a team atmosphere is there when you're doing a menu, for example, or when you're thinking, I mean, there's got to be some pressure, you know, of people now, you have all of these accolades, and they're coming there. Do you feel pressure on creating new menus?
No. And that was one of the main things from the get-go. I didn't want to, you know, we were doing this whole thing. I was like changing the menu every day, and like, I was like, okay, I don't want to change the menu every day. Why? You know, I want to have a life, and I want to be able to make, I want to be confident the dishes are going to be consistent and delicious, you know. And also, I get annoyed when I go to a place and, you know, it's just people just throwing shit into a plate and saying, okay, this is a dish that I come out with. This is bullshit. And I didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to put the stress, not on myself or anybody working at the restaurant, in the kitchen. I mean, this is something that we talk quite often. It's like, I don't, yeah, of course, we're pushing, like, on a daily basis, we're working in different dishes, but it had to make sense. If you want to take something, I mean, the whole menu at Stella, it's like, it's heat. It's like, one thing after the other, it's just, you're going to get slapped on the face. You know, it's just, it's going to happen. And it's very consistent. It's across the board, you know, it's the motivation behind it is to assure that the place is as consistent as it could be. And then coming out with dishes, yeah, we're constantly working on that. There is a lot of limitation with the space. We don't have a tasting a kitchen for doing
tasting menu,
tasting different, you know, and developing menus. It's not really that much space, but we working on that, and like last night we were working on dishes. It was like, what time? 11:30, and that's the time when everything is winding down, and we're talking about the thing, and you know, we taste the foundation of the dish, and today the menu it's on the menu, but it took a little time.
So tell me about New York and Estella. Do you think your restaurant could work in Paris, Montevideo?
I have to say, like, I think the food is, and this is something that I said it from day one, I want to have a universal palate. And when I say universal, it's my mom, it would come and not, and it would enjoy it, and like anybody, it would go there and enjoy it. And that's also why it hits so many people. It's because it's, I believe that it's like universal palate. I mean, you give anybody a hamburger, a burger, and I mean, it's good. What not to like about it? A slice of pizza. And even if we're doing a tartare or if we're doing a crudo, then it could be like super bold, but it just hit this, you know, it just touched the soul. And that's my motivation, is trying to come out with a dish. It doesn't matter your background, who the hell you are. You're going to be like, wow. You know, but the food cannot get on the way of the experience. I mean, it's a fun dining room, very lively. And the food has its moment, but it doesn't take the show. It's not about the chef. It's just about you having a good time on the table.
So when you go out to eat, not at your restaurant,
yeah,
where do you like to eat? Whose food do you admire?
Oh, that's interesting. Where, here in New York? I don't know. I think Joni Adler of Franny's was doing something amazing. I mean, it's a bunch of people. I have a bunch of friends. It's just, yeah, it's a bunch of places. Like, come on, you're compromising me now.
Well, you know, I guess...
I have my neighborhood places that I go, and I really enjoy going, but, yeah.
But is New York... how do you see New York as a culinary city? You know,
it's pretty amazing.
Could you... I mean, do you feel at home here? Do you think this is where you'll always stay? And is... Because I think Estella is a very New York restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and captures that international, universal palate.
But that was also one of the motivation. It's like, it was like, we're in New York. How we can make it as New York as possible? And it's also, it takes a minute to spend. You know, I have spent some time here, and finally, I'm understanding how people want to eat here, and that's something that I took in consideration a lot. It's beyond what I like to eat, you know. And we talk about this a little bit, you know. We do lamb at the restaurant. I hate lamb. But, you know, we have lamb in the menu. People love lamb. So who the fuck cares what I don't like? So, but I can, you know, we're making the ribs in a way that I, you know, if I had to eat them, I fucking eat the lamb. But for
you
the
make it the way you like it, as opposed
yeah.
to, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not broccoli.
I prefer broccoli.
Yeah. What do you think of critics? Have you ever, you know, if you get a bad review, or if you get somebody criticizes you, do you explode?
If they can cook.
Does he explode?
If they can cook, I respect them. If they can cook, sure. If they understand what it takes to open a restaurant, if they work in a restaurant before, I would listen to them. Until then, I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... I'm not doing it for them, and I'm, you know, I believe in what I can do and what the team can do. Like, and I don't want to sound arrogant. It's like this whole same thing. It's like you're not doing it for one person. It's, you know, and taste is a very fascinating. It's very intriguing, you know, how someone can love something and someone else can just hate it. You know, I mean, it's. But, yeah, no, I. If they can cook, if they understand what it takes, then I'm happy to take it. They're doing something, you know, it's a constructive criticism for sure, but, like, it is very blurry, the whole thing.
Why did you open Altera?
Why? Because I love Italian food. And I think it's a lot of Italian restaurants in New York, but I think it's still room to find an identity. Even if it's like much more subtle, like with Estella, it's more of a statement. It's like a much more, I find it easier to people to understand why you're different than the rest. In this one, it just takes a certain maturity to understand the subtleties behind this restaurant, which I think is a beautiful restaurant. I really love it. I think the food, it's 6 months old right now, 5.5. So it needs time, like anything else. You know, Estella, it took us, I don't know, like 1.5 years maybe? I don't know. It took 1.5 years that I remember riding my bike, going back home, and I was like, okay, I can be run by a car right now. And this is going to work, you know? I mean, no, but by that point, you understood what the language was at the place. I think we all knew what the hell we were doing, but it took a little bit of time to figure it out. We have a way of how do we do things. It's a formula behind the things. That doesn't mean that we settle down and, like, we have the formula. We're trying to evolve that. And Altro is on the process of that, you know, and we have, like, this very athletic, handsome, you know, restaurant and that everybody loves, and all of a sudden you get this kid is a little bit, you know, it's a little clumsy, and it's, you know, it's just it's figuring out his way. But I think it's in a really good place. I think, I don't know, I think Altro is in a better place than Estella was at the same age.
Well, practice makes perfect.
Right.
So tell me, who's your favorite diner? You know, what do chefs like to see? Who is their favorite client that comes into a restaurant? What do you like to? What do they act like? What do they order?
I mean, I don't know. You want somebody who's respectful. That's it. You know, respectful to every single member of the staff, and they enjoy themselves, you know, as long as people really enjoy themselves, you know, like, and they're comfortable and they really want to have a good time. They're usually drinking. I don't know. It's really hard to, yeah. I think you want people that are open and willing to enjoy themselves and, like, really put the guard down and, like, have no expectations. I think that's, you know, that's the devil.
Is there an annoying customer in New York? Is there a type?
I mean, foodies.
Foodies taking pictures. Does it bother you when people take pictures of the food?
Well, on that aspect, we made the dining room super dark. So, but then against us, all of a sudden you see all these horrendous photos on the internet, and you're like, fuck me. These people, how people don't realize that this is just a horrendous photo? And they're like posting it, and you're like, great. All right, now our image just is ruined. I don't know, we make it in purpose. Yeah, super dark and like, it's just because it's like, it doesn't really, I don't know, like the food, it's as important as it is, it's not really, it's about you enjoying yourself and having a good time. If you are with a person, you are with a group of people, if you are sitting at the bar alone, just, you want people to really just put the guard down and have a good time and overthink it. And you know, I really appreciate when people come to the back and say, hey, thank you, that was delicious. I was like, that's it. That's, you know, plenty.
So what challenges you these days? What's out there that's exciting and challenging and...
In which way?
In food. Like, what is it...
Like that's people doing?
No, you know, it's... Is there a dish you want to create? Is there a team you want to assemble? Is there a recognition you want to get that is a challenge for you that you're striving towards?
Well, we're doing a new place now, and yes, now it's creating an identity again. You know, you come out with, start with this idea and like, you know, we've been working on the menu for this new place. And, of course, there's just expectations. But at the same time, you are like, doesn't matter. Like, let's focus on, with muscling this whole menu. But it's also really hard because we are not in the kitchen yet. That's challenging. I mean, any opening is really difficult because, you know, you have to put this place up and running with no time, and every day it's an intense round, you know, it's very intense, and you have to do the adjustment very quickly because tomorrow, like, you cannot do the same mistake, and people are coming with a certain level of expectation. So I'm very excited about that. It's really exhausting at the same time, the whole process, but we're working on that now. We're trying to figure it out, like, how we can make it ownable and, yeah, how to come out with another identity. We have a formula, but still we're doing this new restaurant on the Upper East Side, and we want to stay true to what we are. But at the same time, it's a different clientele. And I think it's very important. That's part of the success of Estela or Altro, is like reading and figuring out the need on the community. Like, what is missing? But not just with Estela, perhaps it was like what it was missing at that time in New York, in the location. It's like all these elements.
It's going to be at 75th and Madison at the Met,
that's
Metropolitan
correct.
Museum. That's mm-hmm. exciting. What's the hardest thing you've ever faced in your life?
Wow. Oh, you're like...
Other than this interview.
Like, I don't know. We're not going to go that deep.
Okay.
But like, knee surgery sucks.
Yeah. You've had knee surgery?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's from being a chef.
No.
That's from playing soccer.
Mm-mm.
Oh.
I get into martial arts and I really get excited and, you know.
Which martial art?
Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So anyway, yeah. I was too old for it. Anyway, but that, yeah, surgery is interesting.
Name just a happy moment.
Just to keep the answer light.
Yes.
Well,
What name a happy moment in your life?
Happy moment. I don't know. Every morning I wake up and I have my moment of happiness. People express it in different ways, you know. I don't know. Talking with my son, it feels good. I don't know. Having my cortado and, you know, making sure that it tastes delicious made me pretty happy. That coffee wasn't that good today in the morning. So it was, yeah, it wasn't a good beginning. But anyway, I mean, a good coffee made me pretty happy, I'd say.
I love that answer. I love that answer. It's real.
A good, honest plate of food. I mean, family meal today was pretty simple and delicious. Curry and rice was, like, amazing. Yeah, simple things, you know?
Okay. Well, the great thing is we have this wonderful audience here that came out to see you tonight. And I think we're going to open it up for questions, if that's okay with you. And we might even have some questions on Facebook. So let's turn to the audience. Anybody have any questions here? Oh, come on. You're not making me do all the work up here. He's so sweet.
I have a question. Okay. I have the mic, too, so one of you is next. How do you balance work and your family life?
You fuck up, and then you learn. How do you do that? I don't know. Discipline, like anything. You just need to learn how to be. I'm still trying to figure it out. It's just like being present and try to focus and prioritizing in what matters at that particular moment. It's a challenge for everybody. We're always trying to be somewhere else that we're not, and having something that we are have it right in front of us, but we feel that it's somewhere else. It's tricky. I think every day you just face that challenge, but it's just making smart decisions. It's like what we were saying about, like, perhaps menu, you know? Like, you can drive yourself crazy or just simplify things and try to make it sustainable. And, like, you know, and your mind always screw things up and get you into trouble. But, like, it's controlling the ego and just putting it in place. And reminding that, you know, certain things that know that's important and that most people are not able to see them. But it's, yeah. Still trying to figure it out. I don't know what's the exact answer for it, but I don't know. And I don't know. That's a good one.
Let us know when you figure it out.
Believe me, every day I ask the same question.
More questions. Oh, we have one over there.
Oh, okay. How stylistically different do you want your new restaurant compared to your other restaurants? It's in a museum, I believe.
Yeah. There is similarities. We like what we like. It's like a certain style, like, you know, in terms of material, we like very primal type of materials. In the museum, we're in a place that it has, it's a very famous building, and it has a lot of character, so it was very interesting to get into a space and making sure that what you're doing fits that needs. But still, you need to make it feel comfortable and cozy. But you don't want to copy and paste, right? The same place. But the materials, you know, it's marble, it's bronze, it's steel. And when you get to the food, we're figuring it out. You know, we have all these formulas on how do we do certain things, but you need to get into the space and start figuring it out, like how you want to present it. Like right now for me, it's like how that food is going to look on the plate. It's like, I know that it's going to taste good. I know that but it's just figuring out an identity and an aesthetic in the way that the food is gonna be presented. That for me and it's very important to have that we have it at Estela, but I don't know exactly how we're gonna do it this time. You know, we have a direction somehow, but definitely wanted to make a statement, a bold statement behind it.
We have a question over there.
Yes, Chef. Are there wines produced in Uruguay? Wines.
Wines, yeah, there is wines. Yeah, actually. I'm meeting somebody tomorrow, actually, that's bringing wine because I talk shit about the wines, and now this guy is like, I want to bring you this bottle, and I'm meeting him tomorrow. Yes, there is some good white wines. I mean, the reds are pretty well-known, Tanat. But I haven't been in a long time in Uruguay, so I don't really have that much knowledge about it. And whenever I go, I haven't been impressed by any of the wines. It's good olive oil and good salt. Yeah, which is pretty... I was really shocked. I was there 2 years ago, and I was, like, really blown away by the olive oil that I have over there and salt, which it's interesting. It seems like whatever, but it's changing a lot. It's, like, some good ingredients over there.
Are you... we're going to be starting, first time ever in the world, an olive oil certification program here in October, and we're doing it with the Olive Oil Times. And, you know, the Olive Oil Times every year runs a competition, the only one in the world, of tasting like 1,000 olive oils from all over the world. And so they've done that a few times here. And they realize, you know, with all of the fraud that's going on with olive oil, that you really need people to start tasting olive oil before they buy it, you know, in large places and in restaurants. And the one thing I learned from them hosting them here is that there's southern olive oils and north of the equator and south of the equator, and that you shouldn't eat an olive oil that's more than 6 months old. And so, in fact, if you're really a foodie, you should have two different olive oils, one from the southern hemisphere and one from the northern hemisphere. And when you think about it, their harvesting times are different. And they all are like with terroir of having different flavors and robustness. And so I think we're going to see a real explosion of exciting olive oils in the world. And we're all going to get a lot more refined in tasting olive oils. So, you know, Uruguay, you know, you can get the... We better go down there and find...
Yeah, we do have a good olive oil.
Can you taste a difference in it?
Yeah.
Maybe. Do you cook with it?
I mean, no, now. But we got some samples at the restaurant, and we were using it, and we need to find... I don't know, olive oil, it's fascinating. And I don't know how much you guys know about olive oil, but perhaps, like, at Il Buco, like, I learned a lot about it, and it's very interesting, you know. It's an interesting tool. It can play against you, you know. I mean, sometimes they have so much character that it's all about the olive oil, you know. So you have to learn how to use them and where to locate those olive oils. We kind of simplify that. Stella, we find, you know, perhaps olive oils that are like more malleable and not so robust. And also perhaps we mess around a little bit more. I don't know, I love olive oil, a good olive oil, but of course, usually the good, really good olive oils are impossible to cook with. It's just, you know, bread and oil. That's how you're supposed to eat it.
I tell you, this course, I can't tell you how deep it gets. I was looking at the curriculum, and it goes on for days, but there's so much to learn. But anyway, let's not digress. It was all about you, not you in olive oil. We got another question here.
Yeah. Hi. I have two questions. I'm Uruguayan, by the way.
Wow.
So
impressive. That's like
It's rare.
So I have two questions. The first, it's regarding wine that we were talking before. What do you think, or how's your process of creation? Like when you create the menu, like how do you integrate the wine? Like what's the role of the wine in that creative process? And the second one, so I just throw them all together. It's regarding like Uruguayan wine and like you being also like a Uruguayan ambassador here. Like how do you, like do you feel like that? I don't know, like any responsibility, like to portray your roots, like in your food or like your wine selection or not? Like, have you ever considered that?
Okay, I'm like the worst person for this. Like, seriously. I do not, like Estela, it's actually, and I can talk for my partner too, like the food dictates everything around it. Like, food comes first, wine comes second. And by that, he take care of the selection in a way that, you know, you're picking wines that they're gonna marry it with the food properly. It's not a wine friendly food at all. Like in terms of like very serious wines, we have a clientele that is very knowledgeable about wine. We have some investors that are, you know, big collectors, and it's like, you know what, you cannot bring your wines here. It's not going to work. We're going to screw it up. No, like the wine doesn't dictate how we're doing things. It's all about the food. And then he does his work, you know. I do my job and he does his job and making it fit the right wines. At Altro, perhaps, it's much more friendly for wines. Estela has a lot of acidity. It's like it's a lot going on the food. And when you get to be an ambassador of, like, I don't feel any responsibility to do that. Of course, I very, you know, acknowledge where I come from and being Latin and having a certain, passion and intensity of doing certain things. But I embrace that, but no, I don't feel that. I'm kind of based on New York. I'm in love with this town, and I just love that it's a melting pot of different backgrounds, and I think that that's much more important than trying to, you know, trying to say something about, I don't know, like, of course, I love certain things about the food that I grew up eating, but at the same time, it's not that important. I'm bad at it, sorry. I should not say that.
We have another question here.
Now I know that you're not going to like my question because it's also about Uruguay. But
you're from Uruguay too?
No, I'm from Chile.
No.
But, I know you're very settled here in New York, but in the last 5-6 years, the restaurant scene in South America has been changing a lot, especially with the creation of the Latin America's 50 Best. Haven't you ever felt, like, curious, like, I don't know, like, opening a restaurant in Uruguay or maybe a pop-up restaurant? Because I don't know if you all know, but summer over there in Uruguay is really hot. Everybody goes there. There's a lot happening there. People from all over the world, they go there. You guys have two restaurants in Latin America's 50 Best. Like, haven't you felt curious, like, want to explore, do something over there?
We went 2 years ago for vacation, and it was the best trip in a long time. We went to do a story for Sabor Magazine, and yeah, it was fun, but I'd rather go on vacation. Like, I'd rather go for vacation. South America is great. New York is a very unique place in terms to work in restaurant. It's like people go out all the time and they go all day long. I found South America and Europe very challenging, just in the way that people dine. You know, like people eat in 2 hours. Like people go out between 8 and 10, and it's just horrible. It's you get smacked all in one shot. And then to run a business is very difficult. It's very difficult because, you know, here you have people coming in at 5:30 wanting to come and eat. I'm kind of, you know, it's exciting. I really try to be as supportive as possible, and I think it's great. I mean, it's a lot of potential over there, but I'm in love with this town. It's weird, you know.
We love you back.
Yeah.
Anybody else here from Uruguay? No? Okay, there's another last question here.
Is there a restaurant or a place that you haven't been to yet that you're really excited to try or looking forward to? Some place you're like, I really want to go there?
A restaurant. I haven't been to Attica in Australia, and I think I really want to go to Attica.
That's Ben Shuri.
Ben Shuri, yeah. Great guy. Then I've been eating around quite a bit. I never been to Japan, and that's on the list. And when I go there, it's a big list of restaurants that I really want to go. I think Attica. I think he's doing, again, something with a lot of personality and character. And, you know, a guy that is focused in doing his thing, you know, very committed to the craft of it. That restaurant, Attica.
Okay, did we get any questions on Facebook?
Cool.
Is there someone who has a burning desire? Oh, Katie, is there anybody on Facebook asking a question? Oh, you slackers back home, you know, there. You're just enjoying the show. Well, I want to thank you so much,
Matthew. Thank you.
This is, I just love talking to him. I had the privilege of going over and for coffee last week, and we were just going to talk 15 minutes, and we wound up talking an hour and a half. You know, there's such wisdom here. Thank you so much. And I want to do a shout out. I always do a shout out to my producer, Robin Cohen. She's here tonight. So those of you who want to. And I want to thank Kristen Lau and for helping, and Nick and Katie and Olivia on social media and the filming. And last but not least, Aaron Fairbanks and Heritage Radio. We're so proud to be part of the family. So thanks for coming and watching Chef Story, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.